Hello, friends. Bricky here. Welcome back to episode 2 of Bad Design, Upgrade Downgrades with my co-host, the Dan Stiles, who you can always find his work over at danstiles.com. Dan and I have spent our professional careers in the world of design, both from printmaking, poster making, illustration. Dan's still a full-time designer and someone you can find on the Adobe Mac circuit. And I myself, back in 2014, I went full-time podcaster. And over the years, I've created over 1,300 episodes interviewing hundreds of today's top designers and creative thinkers. And I'm able to see the trends on what makes people able to turn their daydream into their day job. With Bad Design, once a month, Dan and I get together and we take everything that we know about good design and figure out why is what we're looking at bad. To support Bad Design, you can head over to AID.network, become a member of the Circle of Trust to hear the full episode and an archive of over 1,350 other conversations that I've recorded with creatives and creative thinkers just like you. What do you say we get started with episode 2? It's Bad Design, and do us a favor, share this with a friend, let a friend know where you're listening, and we've just gotten the show distributed out to a bunch of different podcast platforms. Maybe wherever you're listening today, could you please leave us a positive review and as many stars as possible? It's episode 2, Bad Design, Upgrade Downgrades.
Settle down! We're about to let you in for the
AID recording.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, I got a question. Is this going to be the same
podcast
flop that we always get from these glamour rock pretty boys that get on
microphone,
dance around with the same lighting angles, the same camera angles? Is this going to be the same kind of video we always get from you guys?
Yes, it is.
Is that good enough for you?
No!
Do you think we can make a better
podcast
than these guys?
Yeah!
Then why don't we take their cameras and make our own
design podcast? Design. 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 Dan Stiles, welcome to Bad Design. How are you, sir?
I love being here. It's like the only human contact I get every month. So.
You still doing a solid lockdown?
I ate in a restaurant like a week ago or something. I'm vaccinated now, so I'm one of those people.
Both shots?
Yeah.
I'm one Got shot
that Pfizer.
In. I'm one shot. Oh, Pfizer. I'm a Moderna guy. One shot in.
Whatever.
I keep wondering which one of these lucky groups is going to be the one that slowly evolves into the Walking Dead, where it's like, oh, if you have Moderna and you die, you come back as a zombie.
Yeah. I'm waiting for that movie.
All right, let's jump into today's topics where we look at bad design and then we try to find something positive to talk about. Speaking of positive, how was your trip out to South by Southwest this year?
Oh, it was great, man. The flight was so easy.
Flew by. All right. One of the things that Dan brought up, which I'm very excited that you picked this. As you know, I've drank the Tesla Kool-Aid. I think that their vehicles are phenomenal. But Dan brought up the new Tesla yoke steering wheel. And Dan, this is one of those things where my heart is conflicted, because a good friend of mine sent this over to me and said, Bricky, have you seen the new Model X that comes with this steering wheel? And the steering wheel looks like what you would see in an airplane. And this steering wheel would make sense in a spaceship or an airplane, because
you know where it makes sense. Fucking Knight Rider.
Knight Rider.
Kit had the yoke steering wheel.
So the yoke steering wheel makes sense where you're literally gliding from side to side. But where I don't think that the yoke steering wheel makes sense is when you have to do hand over hand turns. So even though I love the way this dashboard looks, and I cannot criticize it visually because it shows that we're going into a new era with automobiles and personal transportation, it is bad design. Because Dan, this is what I did one day. Are you ready for this?
Uh-huh.
I took blue painter's tape and I put it on my steering wheel, and I did not allow myself to touch the steering wheel above the blue painter's tape, which would be where the steering wheel would get cut off. It's fucking impossible to drive a car with a steering wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So here's the deal. As we've, I mean, I don't know if everybody knows what a yoke steering wheel is. Imagine a regular steering wheel. It's a wheel. It's round, right?
Right.
A yoke, take the top, slice it off. Take the bottom, slice it off. All you've got are where your hands would be at 9 and 3, like on either side of the airbag. And that's it. There is no top and bottom. It is essentially a rectangular steering wheel. And you, if you watch any motorsports like Formula One, you'll see they have yoke steering wheels. If you're a fan of Knight Rider, you know, they had a yoke steering wheel. And the reason this works in Formula One cars is they have what's called a high steering ratio, which means when you turn a Formula One car wheel just a bit, those front wheels go radically left or right or whatever, right? So those guys are never going very far. A normal passenger car that you and I would drive has 2.5 full rotations lock to lock, which means you're either going hand over hand or you're doing the old school stick shift trick where you palm it on top and you rotate.
Or you have a suicide knob.
Oh, yeah. Or if you're super cool, like a cab driver or something. but yeah, so there's the, you know, you need something to be able to make that wheel turn more than just a few degrees each way. And my guess is what Tesla is going to do, because it's a computerized car and there's no direct connection from the steering wheel to the front wheels, is there's going to be what they call a variable rate. So when you're going slow, you know, that those little inputs you do make big inputs. And when you're on the highway, but then imagine driving a car where depending how fast you're going, your inputs change, right? Like it's, but then on the other hand, nobody believed the iPhone to be a success. They're like, it's going to be this big greasy slab you have pressed up against your face and nobody wants, you know. So, I mean, maybe they really are the wave of the future. You know, maybe they're going to break through and it's going to be amazing, or maybe it's going to be a complete flop. I don't know.
If the steering wheel is, as you said, that it is dependent on your speed and it's predictive to the type of driving that you're doing, what kind of wheel control you need, then this will be the only car that you'll be able to drive. Because already with the regenerative brakes, you know, when you're coming up to a red light, on a typical car, you take 1 foot off the gas and then you put 1 foot on the brake and you start to ease yourself into the red light. Well, with regenerative braking, you let off the gas and the car immediately starts stopping, like when you're on a golf cart. And so the first couple of days, you suck as a driver. But as time goes on, you get very instinctive on when to let go of the pedal to make it to the stop sign or not to hit the car in front of you. It becomes just like a natural instinct. But the problem is with that instinct, when you go back to driving your other car that doesn't have regenerative braking, you almost run into everybody all day long. You almost run every stop sign. You almost smash into everything because it literally feels like going into a boat. Dan, you know, when you drive a boat, you can let off the gas, but it keeps floating, right? Mm-hmm. And you're just like, I really hope that I guess my distance and space properly. That's what it feels like driving once you get off of regenerative braking. So if you're going to tell me that the steering mechanism is going to be very unique and specific to this vehicle, then you have to have this car and drive no other car, because you're going to be broken as a driver if you get in a rental on vacation. You're going to kill your entire family.
Yeah, I'm just curious about that. I mean, they made some other changes with this too. They got rid of the stalks for the steering, for the turn signals. Mm-hmm. So there's now buttons, which makes sense if you never move your hands, right? If you move your hands, finding your turn signal button would be a nightmare. But if your hands only have two spots to go on the wheel, then yeah, you just you know, it's like the triggers on a you know, video game. But I think what they're trying to do here is they're trying to create the future, right? And if you look at this cockpit, you know, it looks incredibly futuristic. And I think they're kind of hoping that maybe in 5 or 10 years, you know, you're not really going to be touching the wheel that much. So you don't really need a full size wheel. You just need this little thing to every now and then catch your car when you feel like making it do something that the computer doesn't want to do.
Well, I think the steering wheel might be designed to lessen driver fatigue, because what happens when you put your car into autonomous mode, it's not like when you're driving a car, Dan, and you have your hands on the steering wheel, you're putting a bit of your body's weight into your two hands. You're kind of leaning into the wheel. And because you're pushing the wheel back and forth, it's actually quite comfortable to have your hands like on something in front of you. But the moment that you go into autonomous mode and you're not driving and you're just like resting your hands on the steering wheel, it's incredibly fatiguing. So I'd be curious to know, is this steering wheel to keep people? Because when I drive, I put my hands on the top of both of my thighs. So when I need to get to the steering wheel, I'm literally 2 inches away from it. I don't get on my phone. I don't like play around with stuff. I keep my hands on my thighs and go up to the wheel if I need to get to the wheel, because it's too fatiguing to hold on. So I wonder if this wheel is designed, the yoke is designed to where if you somehow rest your hands on there, it is more relaxing. Therefore, you would actually keep your hands on the wheel when you're not driving. And by putting the buttons there instead of the stocks, you know, every so often, randomly, the car will ask for you to touch something so that it knows that you're awake, and that also that you're not so buried in your phone that you're no longer paying attention to traffic. So I don't know. I see a lot of problems. I would be curious to test it out and to see, does it create more problems or does it solve more problems?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I mean, they aren't idiots, right? I mean, they're the only company that's managed to build a new automotive company since World War II, and the first company to make an all-electric. Mm-hmm. So obviously, it's not a room full of morons. So I don't think they just did this like, oh, wouldn't that be cool, right? There's got to be some thinking behind it. But this is also the company that has, you know, the autonomous driving mode is not really autonomous, you know. No. So they do sometimes, I think, much like Apple, put the cart before the horse and 100%. Then hope that they can catch up. 100%. Like, oh, we'll put this wheel in here now, and within 5 years, you know, we'll be able to do something with it. So yeah, I just hope they don't, you know, kill people in the meantime.
What's interesting, though, about this cockpit that we're looking at, and when you think about when you have a car company, you know, car companies make different models or different classes, literally for different classes of people, right? And, you know, car companies also will have their everyday guy line. You know, there's a Toyota if you're working class, but if you have a little bit more money, you can get what Toyota's equivalent is, Lexus, right? That's their premium brand. So, you know, car companies try to make classes of cars for classes of people. But what's interesting about this cockpit in the Model X is that this is very similar to their cheaper cars, which is the Model Y and the Model 3, where typically with the Model S and the Model X, you get a long vertical screen that sits between the driver and the passenger. You get a secondary screen above your steering wheel, and you just have some various buttons here and there. Well, this design is the cheaper cars with just a little extra monitor up above your steering wheel. So it's interesting that they're going with this simple design, even for their more luxury models. I mean, there's a serious price difference between a Model Y and a Model X. I mean, you know, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And so it's interesting that they're going to give that much more expensive customer the same thing that they gave me, which is one of their more value-tiered customers.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe they just figured something out. They're like, look, we don't need, you know, I mean, I've talked to you about it before, and you don't maybe need the dashboard where you think you need the dashboard anymore. And after a few years of it, they're like, hey, this center stack is working great.
The center thing, when I saw that, I thought it looked cheap. I thought it looked generic. And I said, man, why even buy a Model 3 if that's what they're going to give you? And then when I saw that the Y was designed the same way, I'm like, well, we'll give it a shot because that's what we can afford. And holy shit, it is so incredibly efficient having two buttons and a giant iPad on your dashboard. Incredibly efficient.
Yeah. So I think they probably figured, like I said, you know, they're not idiots. They probably figured a few things out. But this is, I think, you know, I can't tell if this is the type of thing where they did this with the hopes that people like you and I would talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, when it comes to the final rollout, they're like, yeah, you know, we didn't do that. But I think testers have been spotted with this steering wheel in it.
Oh, wow.
So it has made it to production. But yeah, I don't know if this is the kind of thing that's going to quietly go away or if this is, you know, the wave of the future. And you and I are just sort of howling about it because it isn't, you know, how we used to do it back in the day.
I do feel like, though, if you had this steering wheel and you're going 80 on the highway, you probably feel like you're going like 100.
Oh,
like,
man. It's badass. You know, they're good at making badass stuff.
All right. So that's one of the things that Dan had this month. One of the things that I wanted to bring up, and this is a little bit more of an abstract conversation, but you're the right person to have it with. The trend of debranding. Debranding is the new branding, right? And last month, we gave props to Burger King that abandoned their, you know, .com type logo, as you love to call them, for the more, you know, old school burger type logo. And the thing that is interesting is that, you know, this debranding, it works. When we look at this Rolling Stone logo, you know, taking out all of that extra flair, it actually is more communicative. When we look at Warner Brothers with the gold and the reflections and just going over the shield with the typography, like, it actually does work. It is efficient. But the problem with why I'm going for debranding as bad design is that it's every single company's initiative now to take what they had, what they had grading it up, what they put way too many colors in, and break it down. And some of them are just going so completely polar opposite that it's not debranding. I'm labeling it as brandless. It just starts to look like fonts and no longer typography, no longer a communicative symbol that represents a business.
Yeah, I think you have a good point. One of the ones that I didn't put in this week because we already had Tesla in there and I didn't want to harp too much on cars was Renault, the French car maker, just redid their logo. And they had, as you scroll through this page here, they had the same deal. They had that 90s thing where it looked like it was kind of like this weird Photoshop gradient. It's made out of metal, you know, it's got a little angle on it and it looks stupid, right? And their new one is beautiful. I think they did a great job just trimming it down, but everybody appears to be sort of going back to where they were before desktop publishing ruined everything.
Right.
So they're getting rid of the 80s logos and the 90s logos, and they're really going back to, you know, the standards of what make a logo good, which is, does it have a strong silhouette? Does it work in black and white? Does it, you know, is it an actual freaking logo? Not this weird 3D rendering of a logo. But I think you are correct in that it's now the current trend. So in 10 years, everybody's going to move away from their debranded logo. Right. But they're flattening it out almost too far. And
yeah.
They're losing some of the things that made it interesting. And I wonder if part of that is because things need to work at such a tiny scale now.
Yes. You brought up something that, you know, for a while, everything got really complex. And now when, you know, I'm assuming CEOs and decision makers see their new $5 million app and they go, you can't read our logo up in the top of that. You know, we live and speak a design language where we know that a hamburger means that's where all the options are at. Right? You look for that little hamburger on every app. You go, oh, it's just go to the hamburger. Then I can find it's the hamburger helper. That's what they should call it. But I'm wondering if you're right. You know, it used to be when you and I went to school for design, it was like a good logo looks great on a billboard and on a postage stamp. Because if it can do those two things, it can do everything in between. And I think for a while we really focused on the billboard and we said, fuck the postage stamp.
Yeah, and now it needs to look good at 8 pixels by 8 pixels.
Right, which is hard.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everybody's got an app now, and the apps is kind of the biggest interface for a lot of companies. And so that real estate on your iPhone screen is now the most important placement of their logo. And, you know, nobody's putting it on their corporate jet anymore. But I am interested to see what comes out of this trend as everybody. And it's, I kind of hate trends for that reason.
I know.
Because a debranded mark, a lot of these marks are really, they're much better. I'm glad they're doing it.
Right.
But then everybody's going to jump on. They're going to fuck it up somehow. I don't know how. And then everybody's going to jump back off.
Well, I kind of feel like we're at that fuck up moment because there are some brands that debranding has made them so much more relevant and look so much better. Like, you know, Burger King is a classic example. And man, do we love picking on Burger King on this show. But then it gets to the point where because everybody else is doing it, we have to do it. And I just don't feel like taking your old logo and taking out all of the complexity is the way to do it. For example, the Nissan logo, it looks like shit. I mean, it was a fine logo when it was the metal logo. I don't think that's a perfect logo, but just like pulling everything out and just putting the font there with like the little weird like emblem around it. Like, I'm just not a fan of how basic some of these are. So I think that it is the problem with trends is that everybody follows them, and good design, you know, good trends in design, like a movement like debranding, I should say, is really great for some logos. It's really horrible for others, but everybody's jumping on. And so you get this grab bag of like, Volkswagen, what are you doing? You have such a great semblance with the V and the W and their relationship together. This version of the VW logo looks horrible.
Yeah, a lot of these have lost their weight. Nissan in particular, there's just no mass.
Yeah.
Like it's all negative space. So that's not really much of a mark, right? You know, if you blur your, squint your eyes at that, the whole freaking thing disappears, which is the opposite of what a logo should do.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how effective some of them are, but then just how, I don't know. I mean, I know that it's not the case because I've done the work before, but a lot of them just look lazy. Like, for example, they took a study of a lot of like, you know, clothing brands that used to be a little bit more like, you know, serif based and had a little bit more of like prestige in them. And when you look at them now, it just looks like I'm looking at defont.com trying to figure out which font to download for my next project. Like these these fashion brands don't look like marks anymore. They look like fonts.
Those all look like Futura Medium, don't they?
They do. I mean, I know, hey, there's people that are making good money somewhere doing these upgrade downgrades, but I don't know. I just think that what would be interesting is for a company to figure out where they should go individually and not be like, oh, we got to rip it all apart. We got to get down to as basic bitch as possible.
Yeah. Is it because the people in marketing need to earn their keep? I mean, you know, they come up and they say, everybody else is doing this. We got to do this too. I just really am surprised there isn't some initiative behind it. Like, oh, we're coming out with this new line of whatever. Now would be a great time to right. update this.
Now's the time to jump on board, to go with the new trend. It just seems like everybody's doing it kind of because everybody else has. And that's not exactly what I enjoy. Hey, friends, today's episode of Bad Design is brought to you by our friends over at GARM. That's Graphic Artist Resource Merchant. Available for you online at garmcompany.com. And hey, while you're there, coupon code AID will always make sure you save on each and every product that you buy. And good news, they have a spring sale going on, up to 50% off select products. And you're going to save even more when you put in the coupon code AID. That's right. We're going past 50% off. GARM was designed by my friend Amir of the Forefathers, who is an amazing graphic designer and maybe even better illustrator for branding. The guy's got a phenomenal eye and an even better hand. He's handpicking all the different artists he works with, all the different textures, all the different brushes, and all the different clip art that you can easily purchase to get to the fun parts faster, because somebody already spent an afternoon figuring out the hard parts for you. It's garmcompany.com, coupon code SITEWIDE AID. Head over there now, because between now and the end of the month, massive spring sale, and you're going to save even more for listening to Adventures in Design and Bad Design. Speaking of trends, Dan, I get a lot of, you know, PR people and stuff that say, hey, you know, we want to bring so-and-so on your podcast. We think that they would be a good fit to speak to your audience. And I can always be like, you have no idea how I speak or who my audience is. But if you think so, we'll try it out.
You ever listen to this show?
I mean, you know, Monday we debated for hours if Winter Soldier jerks off with his mechanical hand, does it feel like somebody else is touching him? Like, that's where we're at with design on this show, especially when I got Sean Mort with me. But Dan, the thing that keeps getting pitched to me over and over again is there's this whole new way that ad agencies are being ran, where, you know, they do UI, UX. They've decided to call imaginary stuff products so they feel more validated in what they're selling to people. And, you know, branding is still alive, but there's this whole other, like, and I don't know if it's a fallout from Trumpism, but there's this new sector in the agency world, which is like empathy design. You know, like, how do we make your company more empathetic, more of a culture for your employees, if you're a big company, or for your clients? And I've now started to interview people where they actually keep, like, you know, psychologists on staff. You know, they have designers, marketing people, business people, you know, working alongside with, you know, mental professionals to try to get into this new, like, emotional branding for your company. I talked to a woman last week that gave me a really nice, honest, and straight up breakdown on it. And she was the first one that gave me real talk, because a lot of people, they give you the definition when they're defining it. And that's kind of, you're not allowed to put the word in the definition, right? Like, if I say, hey,
right, sure,
what does that word mean? You can't tell me that word when you're explaining it to me. So I don't know. I don't know if you've seen this much from where you're at, but it seems like the agencies are kind of going after this different kind of, I'm not going to say cash grab, but this different sort of opportunity to make companies more relatable to their customers, to their employees.
It's the relatable thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because now everything is kind of the same shit. Like, you can't differentiate based on the quality of your product anymore.
Right.
I mean, most, you know, look at, for instance, like, you're a streetwear company. Everybody sells whatever their Timberland boots are with their logo on it, whatever their flannel shirt is with their logo on it, whatever their Carhartt jacket is with their logo on it. Like, it's all the same shit. So in order to stand out in the market now, you need to have a brand like, oh, well, I like Supreme way better than I like, you know, whatever.
Right.
It's the same stuff. So it really is all about emotional attachment to the brand, because you're not selling goods anymore.
See, I was looking at it. I mean, you make a great point. I wasn't thinking about taking, you know, the kid version, you know, the Supreme example, and putting that over to like Blue Cross Blue Shield. You know, like, how are they trying to make themselves the Supreme of healthcare? I wasn't looking at it from that direction. I was looking at it from the direction of, I think that the younger generations have a whole different understanding of the world as the older generations. And I was seeing this as agencies dipping in there and be like, we help out with diversity and empathy and, you know, like all these sure. buzzwords of understanding and bridging the gap. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of CEOs that are afraid of their company being the next to get canceled or be on the backside of culture, which is fascinating that cancel culture is going so hard when we just had, you know, Trumpism just this time last year. Like, I don't know. I feel like there's a real weird, like a schizophrenic emotionalism of America where we don't know if we hate everybody or we're sitting at home crying because we love everybody.
I'm not sure cancel culture is even a real thing, honestly, but you know, I think you're right. Actually, I think your take on this is probably better than mine, in that we do have a new generation of people and they're trying to reach them using that same language of inclusiveness,
right?
And all the things that might have come out of, you know, BLM, or even the experience of being a, you know, a broke ass millennial in capitalism or something, where, you know, you're like, this whole every man for himself, harden up, bootstraps thing is absolute bullshit.
Yeah.
And so do you want your brand to still speak that language, or do you want your brand to speak the language of, you know, let's just say Bernie Sanders?
Right.
And I think depending on what you're selling, you know, you're probably going to want to go more Bernie than you are, you know.
Yeah, I think there's like a fundamental difference on younger people. They see the world differently. You know, they've been fed a different format of media than older generations. You know, like, everybody's gay, everybody's non-binary, everybody is in this moment of, you know, kumbaya and understanding. And I'm here for it. I think that it's significantly better than where it was 60 years ago. But I also know that there's sort of a sensitivity and sort of a, you know, everything's out to get me type of mindset where businesses are trying to penetrate that and break through and be like, no, we care about homeless people just like you do. You know, we care about the sea turtles, VSCO girls. So I'm trying to figure out like how the agency world is reacting to this. And is there a new form of design on the horizon that's no longer visual? It's no longer interactive, but an emotional design. Is like an emotional design becoming a new category out there? Because yeah. I've seen it pop up in more than one spot, which normally gets my spidey senses going, I think I'm recognizing a trend.
Yeah, it's almost like user experience has now jumped off the screen. Mm-hmm. And now user experience is, you know, every time you come in contact with this brand, how does it make you feel?
Right. Emotional experience.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Going back over to you. This is something I could talk about. I could do a whole episode on this. You wanted to bring up the fact that mask and why no one can make a mask that doesn't suck. And I have to tell you, brother, you are preaching to the choir. I watch a lot of YouTube and I see a lot of people wearing masks and I go, what makes you think that mask is right for your face? Either two things happen, Dan. Either their nose is always falling out, which is just annoying because, like, you know, why would you wear a mask and not cover all the holes that you need to cover? Or they wear something that's so big and it like crinkles and your head ends up looking like a McDonald's cheeseburger character from the 70s. Like, all I see is a big burger box with like two eyes on top of it.
Feed bag. Yeah, I don't get it. And this is just something that, you know, I'm relatively new to this whole wearing glasses thing. Like, I made it through most of my life without needing glasses. And now I wear glasses pretty regularly. And as anybody out there listening knows, you can't wear any mask. I don't care who makes it with glasses.
They I miss sunglasses fall. So much. I miss sunglasses in the worst way, but they're so fucking frustrating.
Yeah. And it's amazing to me that this is a product that has a built-in audience of 8 billion people. Everybody on the planet right now is wearing a mask every single fucking day, except for a couple morons. And other than, you know, a real high-end N95 or a full-on respirator, none of them fit. None of them work. They are leaky around the edges or whatever the thing is. And I can't believe that we can, you know, develop 100 different ways to strap your balls to your body so you can run fast.
Right.
But we can't figure out a way to attach a, you know, and granted our heads are kind of funny shaped and all. It's a hell of a design problem.
Right.
But why isn't somebody out there, you know, just solving this?
it's almost like what somebody would need to do is take like a Nike approach and say, well, these are shoes that are for running, and these are shoes that are for climbing, and this is streetwear, this is fashion. And it's almost like somebody needs to just be honest and say, this is a mask perfectly designed for people that have this type of face. This is a mask that's perfect for guys that have beards or whatever, you know, like create different sort of outer contour lines for the shape of different faces. I know for me, the one thing that is crucial, I did some searching around. I finally found the best that I can get. Now, sometimes if I crank this mask on hard enough, I can get away with sunglasses for a while. But what I find to be crucial in a mask is the following. It has to have another piece of fabric that locks over the chin. You know, like I need it to lock over the chin. So therefore, if I'm talking, it's not constantly coming down, because I hate when you see somebody doing an interview and they keep pulling their mask up. So when I film, I wear a mask that goes locks under the chin and it stays in place. And I pull it back so much that my one ear is not as strong as my other. My ear like flips over to the side. And then the other thing that it has to have for me is it has to have the wiring on the bridge of the nose, so that you can take that hard wire, press it down to your nose, and get a perfect fit. Then you have the ability to put your glasses over the top of that wire. You've locked out the airflow and your glasses won't fog up. I found a company that made a perfect mask. So I tried to buy three more, one for each vehicle and one by the door, to when I go out to walk the dogs. And then the mask that I already have would just stay in my filming bag. Well, the problem is, I guess as their demand got so big, they decided to cheapen the quality of the wire that goes over the bridge. So now there's a wire in there, but it doesn't mold or form like the original, tougher, I'm assuming more expensive wire did. The wire over the bridge of the nose, to me, it has to have that, or I don't even mess with it.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that was like COVID 101, where for the first month you were tying t-shirts around your face and shit. And then eventually you could get a real surgical mask that had the wire, and it was a game changer. You know, that was, you know, the tech step one. But I just can't believe they can't make one that has the fitment that you would need. And I don't know what, you know, a magic stretchy one, something that, you know, pulls over your face super tight or something. And then, you know, maybe the filters come in and out so you can change the filter in it or something. But, you know, it's supposed to filter and it's supposed to fit. And most of them don't fit, and a lot of them, you know, don't filter. And we've been doing this for a year now, and it just looks like a huge missed opportunity.
I'm just really surprised that someone like Nike didn't take all of their research and development and put a team on it and just make, you know, just different cuts, different ways. Like, you know, this one actually, like the nose goes into a spot, or this one rolls this way, or, you know, try to figure out a way where the mask combos with glasses, or, you know what I mean? There's so many different ways this could go, but it seems like the only people that bought on, as you said, what, 8 billion potential customers? It just seems like the sort of like these, you know, I'm calling it the way I see it, more low life companies, like we can pivot and make signs, like, or a mask. I feel like every mask is made from like Italian guys in New Jersey, and then they get shipped over to
California. There's a company in town here that sells vacuum cleaners, and they had access, I guess, to vacuum cleaner bags. And so they're like, fuck it, we're making masks. And they, you know, they've changed their entire business. I mean, they've done really well for themselves, and good on them. But it's literally, they're called Stark Vacuums because they're on Stark Street and they sell fucking vacuum cleaners.
Wow.
And now that's they're a pivot, big man. Ass mask company.
That's a pivot. Okay, so a couple things I'd like to say about mask design. I personally, you can find photos of me where my first ever mask was given to me by a friend who I call her Eyebrows to the Stars, because she does eyebrows for the stars. And so you couldn't go to any of the stars' homes and do their eyebrows. So she pivoted over into sewing, and she made me a Mickey Mouse mask and gave it to me. And it was my first mask, and I appreciated it. But then when I could find a black mask so I could look like the trained killer that I am, highly vigilant. I've watched every episode of 24. I took the Jack Bauer School of Terrorism training, so I know how to do anything I need to on a plane. I like the black mask. What I do not enjoy are these masks that people wear that have the color piping around the edges. So, you know, the base of the mask is one color, and then it has like a second color around the edge. Originally, when I saw those, I go, oh, that's cool. I like that it has the trim. But then when people started wearing them, I'm like, it looks like you have a little boy's pair of underoos over your face.
All right, I had not noticed that, but I think masks are much like glasses in that it's an unfortunate statement that you have to wear on your face.
Yep.
Like, I would prefer just not to wear glasses, because any glasses you put on, the frame is going to tell something about yourself.
Right.
Like, ooh, he's a designer, or ooh, he's a douchebag, or, you know, whatever it is. You got the thick frames or the thin frames, or they're bright red. And the mask is the exact same thing. You know, you are now strapping a thing to your face that you have selected. And if it's glittery and pink, that just says something about you.
Right.
Or if it's just solid black, like I always get mine in solid black, but that kind of says something about me.
Right.
Along with my douchebag designer glasses.
But I don't know. Like, I see all these different patterns and stuff. And for me, I mean, maybe this is making me like a, you know, like a grumpy old man, which I hope I'm not becoming, but I was just like, I don't want to get into mask design. I want this movement to go by fast. To me, it's utility, not fashion. And I understand that people interpret things differently, but just all the patterns and different things, and I'm like, fuck, man. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't want to be like decorating the apocalypse. I want to just get through this shit fast.
You're a black t-shirt guy too, though.
True. Very true. And I would tell you right now, mostly everybody listening is, has a beard, a black t-shirt, and slightly overweight. I know my demo. I know who I'm catering to here. Some guy sitting someplace is like, oh man, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah, that's me.
All right. So work me through this next one on your list. What is
NFTs?
What's NFTs?
Holy shit. No, Mark, you are not, you have not completely sat out the whole NFT thing. Have you? You are like plugged into the media.
What's NFT?
A non-fungible token.
Yeah. I just want
to talk about this, because I wanted to talk to you. I'm not even going to say this is bad design. I am just really curious to spend a couple minutes talking to you about your opinion on NFTs. And I'm sure most of the people out there listening, because they're in the world of art and design, have heard about this and have opinions on it, or are completely confused by it. But as I understand it, and I am certainly no expert, a non-fungible token is essentially a way to put your art into the blockchain.
Right.
And so when you can now buy essentially a JPEG, or, you know, an MPEG or whatever, you can buy a digital piece of art. That digital piece of art is connected to the blockchain. So it is a way to sell limited edition art, but digitally, as opposed to having to print it on a piece of paper, or, you know, a t-shirt, or paint it on a canvas and hang it on the wall. You can now say, this is a one of one or a one of 10. And here's a token that, you know, can't be counterfeited, and you can now buy this, and people are buying them for quite literally millions of dollars now. I mean, I think we are obviously in a bubble where people are going after certain artists like Beeple and spending, you know, just insane amounts of cash that they would never spend on that same piece of art in a traditional format. And, you know, the market's going nuts, and now everybody's throwing their hats in the ring. And you know, full disclosure, I've been asked by people to do this as well. So don't be shocked if you know, NFTs start coming out of me. But it is it's a new form of art. And I think it's definitely a bubble. I think there's definitely issues with it. But the one thing I do enjoy is that, just like MP3s allowed you to now kind of have digital music.
Yeah.
And obviously had growing pains, and obviously I think hurt recording artists.
Yep.
But they did allow you to carry your music in your pocket, or send your music to your friends over the internet.
1,000 songs in your pocket was the promise when you bought your iPod.
Yeah. I think the fact that you can now collect digital artwork, because think about it, if you're like an animator, your job is to essentially work for free, put your stuff on Instagram, and hope that a paying client will come along and say, oh, can you do us a commercial in that style? That was really what you were hoping for. And now you can actually make a little animation of anything you want, and you can publish it as an NFT, and somebody could buy it. Just like you could buy a t-shirt or a poster or a pair of Nike shoes or any other collectible. And so I do think that is really the upside of this. And I think, you know, I think the market's going to settle down. I think there are a shit ton of technical problems with them still.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, the art itself is not in the blockchain. All you're getting in the blockchain is an address that points to a place where the art is, where that art can be taken down. You know, they can do what's called closing the window. So if you sell somebody a piece of art and then somebody else comes up and says, hey, you know, that art's plagiarized, they'll just vanish your NFT. You know, that can be done.
So the reason why I didn't even know what the initial stood for is when this was explained to me, And maybe once again, maybe I'm becoming old and outdated, but I just looked at it from three major things hit me right out of the gate where I'm like, I'm not even going to give this that much of my time. One, it was happening so fast and so trendy and people were making such quick money. Bubble. You know, mm-hmm. I saw sure. This is a new fucking Beanie Baby. Like, this is a 100%. Bubble. People are getting jacked up on it. But then I also started to look at it immediately. Like, this is a fucking scam. This is a scam. And hey, if the artist can pull a scam on rich guy collectors, more power to you. If you can make $1 million doing these, I'm never going to make fun of you. In fact, I'll high five you. But I said, I see this as a scam. So therefore, bubble means instant, scam means no longevity. And then the third reason why I just put my hands up, I'm like, I don't want to be a part of this. I don't see any pleasure out of the product. When you downloaded an MP3, you said, holy shit, because I have Napster or LimeWire, I can now listen to all the old Van Halen records that I lost along the way living in a different apartment every year of my life. You know, when you downloaded the MP3, you could put it into something, you could listen to it, you could exercise to it, you could drive your car to it. And then once the bandwidth caught up and you could download movies, you could enjoy the movie and take part in it. Art, I love it. I love to observe it. But I don't see the pleasure in having a JPEG on a hard drive simply because we now see 10,000 of these a day. You see more JPEGs than you could ever listen to songs. You see more JPEGs than you could ever watch movies. And part of what hurts my brain on this, when I had this epiphany one day, Dan, it blew my fucking mind. I said, okay, let me get this straight. George Lucas used to go make a Star Wars movie. And then the Star Wars movie would go out into movie theaters and they would make lots of different copies. And you and I would essentially, we would pay our, back in the day, $10 to be a part owner of that copy and to see it one time, one use. And then we had to leave. If we loved it so much, we'd have to buy $10 to own it for 90 minutes again. And then I realized that, you know, in DVDs, they would take that movie and they would press thousands of them and we would all buy them. We'd all own our own copy. But then when iTunes came around, I go, holy shit, my version of Star Wars and Dan's version of Star Wars is the exact same copy of Star Wars. They're putting one fucking file on a hard drive and going, this is everybody's. And then that one file gets bought, you know, a million fucking times. And to me, I don't see the value in that for art. Like, I can see the value in music or film or TV, because that's something that you get to enjoy. Art is something that you possess and that you hang into a home or become a part of it. I just don't see the pleasure in this. So there's a part of my brain that just doesn't give a fuck. Like, I'm zero interested in this.
Yeah. And you know, I'm the same age you are, maybe a little older. So, you know, this is definitely hurting my old man brain too.
Right.
But there are things, just to play devil's advocate on this, you know.
Please do. Please push back.
This notion of sort of this Ready Player One reality that we're headed for, or Snow Crash, or any one of these, you know, pieces of fiction that was written 10 years ago, back when this notion of living in the internet was like, whoa, you know, and now we all just live there and we don't give a shit, right? You know, it doesn't even matter. And I think we're coming closer to that every day. And I think people, younger generations than us, are perfectly happy with living out their life inside. You know, you can go to a video game, you can whatever game it is now, and you can buy skins, right? And a lot of these people, they pay a lot of money to get skins for their players, and to set up, you know, all these different things around this virtual life. And so there are people already making money selling virtual weapons and you know, virtual t-shirts. And I'm, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Nike already has a virtual department selling, you know, virtual shoes. And so is virtual art really that weird?
But see, once again, I can understand because, okay, I used to love to play this Simpsons game called Tapped Out or whatever, where basically you're building your own, like, Springfield, right? Because I love the idea of the Sim City. I love building and constructing cities. And so it's a free game. And then, you know, they'll be like, hey, for a limited time, if you do all these conquests, you can unlock these different buildings. But if you want this one particular building, you have to buy credits that then buy it. It's money. And so I would say, you know, here I am playing this game several hours a day. I owe it to these creators to put $5, $10 into the till so that I can get this thing that I want and pay them. But once again, that is a part of a game that I'm enjoying. I don't see the enjoyment of owning a JPEG. I've joked about it forever. When people started making enamel pens, I said, finally, we've been able to do what we've always wanted to do, sell people JPEGs. Because enamel pens to me seem like you make a JPEG, turn it into a pen. But I just, I don't know. I don't see the pleasure. So therefore, with the other two things that I mentioned, Bubble and Scam, I don't see it going the long haul. I could be completely wrong, but I don't see it going the long haul.
Yeah, I'm curious as well. Obviously, it's a new thing, and I think the Bubble thing is for sure.
Yeah.
But I do wonder that the reason I would put any stock in it is that MP3 analogy,
mm-hmm.
In that, you know, people are okay now with owning things in a non-physical format.
Sure.
So, and yeah, I totally get it. You can't go running and look at your phone at your amazing JPEG, but you can go running and listen to your old, you know, Van Halen MP3s. So the experience is certainly different. And that's one of the things that I'm sort of surprised that they, and I'm sure people are working on this. There's actually something called, I think, like a Forever Play or whatever, which is a, like Beeple. If you buy his stuff, he will actually send you a physical little screen, that's got a little stamp on the back, so it's real, and it plays your JPEG over and over again. So you do actually get a physical product from
that. That makes sense.
And so I think the gap is being bridged. Maybe they're, you know, like those frames you can get that shuffle through photos,
right? I'm sure you've seen those. Or the TVs that are designed to look like wall art and not a TV. So as soon as you turn your TV off and you stop watching TV, then the TV transforms into a canvas and you tell it what kind of art you want to put in there.
And now imagine, I mean, you're a tech guy, you like tech. Imagine you had one of these TVs, if you don't already, and you had a chance to buy a piece of art from somebody you really admire, you know, an artist you really like. You want them in your home. You want people to walk in and see this art in your home. You would like to enjoy this art on your couch, but it's digital. You know, you download it straight to your TV set. You know, would you be tempted?
Yeah, I don't think I would be.
All right.
I mean, I just don't. Part of what I love about art and what I think makes it invincible against all technologies is that it's tactile. There is something spiritual, and I'm not a spiritual person, but there is something spiritual about picking up a piece of paper and seeing that somebody was there before you, you know, whether it's the pencil marks, whether it's the brush strokes, whether it's being able to feel how the silk screener laid the colors over one another. And you can see that little bit of, you know, black living underneath the pink or vice versa. Like, I don't know. I don't enjoy JPEGs because I'm just around them. They're like a utility to me. You know what I mean? Like, it would be hard to be like, here's what you can do. I'm going to bit chain you electricity. You own a little bit of electricity, okay? You have a little bit of electricity that you now own. Hey, this does remind me of, I love just giving people completely dry, sarcastic humor and hoping that they know that I'm joking. And Dan, a long time ago, before I lived out here, when I was working with the Coalition of Independent Music Stores, we were out on Sunset Boulevard. They had all the major record labels in there. You know, we're doing our thing, hanging out, doing showcases and stuff. And I was talking to the guy, I think he was like the head of like Sony or Warner Brothers at the time, but like a fucking player, right? Like a player in the music industry. And so everybody's just kind of sitting there talking and he just looks over and he goes, oh, so what do you do? Because he was just asking people, what do you do for the Coalition? You know, and the real answer would have been that I was on the online, like, you know, marketing team. But the answer I chose to give him, because there were a lot of different people that got invited there, I'm like, oh, I'm just about ready to wrap up a new business that I'm launching where I've figured out how to buy, sell, and trade used MP3s. And the look on this guy's face was like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me? People are selling used MP3s? And the fucking president of the organization, Don, was next to me, goes, don't listen to this guy. He's an asshole.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, the look on the suit's face was like, you're fucking kidding me. That's where this is all going. Hey friends, I hope you enjoyed part one of today's episode of Bad Design episode 2. I hope you're enjoying this new podcast between Dan Stiles and myself, Don't forget, you can always find Dan over at danstyles.com, and you can always find more podcasts by me over at AID.network. And that's also where you can find the second part of today's episode. I don't run a lot of ads. It's not all jammed up with advertising, and I put out over 200 episodes each and every year for the AID.network. And that is made possible by my members of the Circle of Trust. So if you enjoyed what you heard today, you want to keep this going, keep this showing up monthly, as well as all the other interviews. Been on a rip lately of doing some really deep dive with some design intellectuals, just trying to figure out where the agency world is going, how the design landscape is shifting after the last year that we all spent through the pandemic. So if you would like to hear some of that in the second part of today's episode, please head over to AID.network, become a member of the Circle of Trust, and help the circle keep on growing. It's now time for part two of Bad Design, available exclusively for members of the Circle of Trust right now at AID.network. All right, Dan, you said cancel culture doesn't exist. Let's put that theory to test. There is the new Amazon app icon where instead of doing the shitty shopping cart, the Amazon logo over to the left, shopping cart to the bottom right, they decided, hey, what do people really know our brand as? They know our brand as the boxes that show up to the house. They know our brand as the blue tape that we use to seal them. And they know our brand from, you know, what started out as an arrow and has become a smile. They changed that along the way. So they came up with this app. And then people go, got to get rid of it. Looks like Hitler. And this gets into an interesting spot. You wouldn't want people to be reminded of Hitler. That's just not good for business, and it's not good for the people that that might actually trigger. But I ponder, does it really look like Hitler, or are people just fucking trolling them? Like, is this a thing where you make a design and you love it and somebody goes, nope, looks too close to a swastika, throw it in the garbage?
Well, you know, I mean, that's design school 101. Back to our logo design 101 is don't make it look like a dick and balls. Don't make it look
like Hitler,
like a swastika. You know? And I'll throw Hitler on the list along with swastika. Right. Subgenre of the swastika would be Hitler. And so I can see it looking at that. You know, I would definitely crack that joke the minute I saw that, especially if that tape was black. But, you know, at least it's blue. Yeah. They could have saved this, put that box at a bit of an angle or something. You know, like there's something they could have done here. But yeah. But did they? That's the problem with cancel culture. Like, people said, oh, this looks like Hitler, and then Twitter lit the fuck up because that's what Twitter does, right? But nobody got all butthurt about it, right? They were just like, ha ha, you made Hitler,
right?
And they're like, oh, okay, we should take that down, you know? And that's just like, remember the first Trump Pence logo with the T, like butt fucking the P? And everybody just rooted them for that, right?
Yeah.
And so they had to get, like, overnight that shit vanished, as it should, you know. Right. Like, bad design in the age of the internet has a half-life of about 12 hours.
So for this particular logo, though, and for, you know, the cancel culture movement, I do believe, I don't want to sound like an old fuddy-duddy here, I do believe that corporations have an obligation, and I believe that as society we have a standard that we should all live at. But it's almost starting to feel like, and there are some people that certainly have been canceled that had it coming to them. They got exactly what they deserve for just being an asshole. But I do feel like there's now a sector of the internet where it's that scene in Frankenstein where all the villagers have their pitchforks, they have their torches, and they're just out on the streets, like, looking for something to cancel. And I don't know, man, like, clearly they didn't make this to look like Hitler. Forcing them or trying to force them to take it down. I just feel like we're almost in this bizarre culture war that if you don't try to make everybody happy, then you're essentially trying to piss on the face of everybody. You know what I mean? Like, there's this weird balance of like, well, they don't care about people because they wouldn't change their logo. I don't know, man. It's a fucking box with tape on it. Calm down.
Yeah. I mean, we do live in a period of time now where that mob is just ready and waiting at all times.
Yeah.
I think you're right. And if, you know, it's that you can't please everyone thing, right?
Right.
There's everything you put out there is going to step on somebody's toes. And now, again, thanks to the internet, you know, those somebodies used to kind of be alone, but now they can all band together and say, you know, this is horrible, which gets back to this touchy-feely branding thing you were talking about earlier in the show.
True.
Where companies now essentially have to build into their process in advance, like, all right, we got to have a meeting. We got to put the new box logo up on the wall, and we got to make sure nobody in this room is offended by it, which means everybody in this room better be coming at it from different angles. Like, we have a bunch of fucking 30-year-old white dudes in this room.
Right, we're done.
We're going to miss something, right? Right? So we need to get a bunch of people in here who are more representative of American society to say, hey, you know, we were thinking of putting a little feather in his hat, you know, and like, there's going to be somebody in the back's going to be like, you know what, bad idea. And, you know, maybe for good reason. I don't know.
I mean, the thing is that ultimately the change to it of taking off the cuts from the tape gun and making it just a blue square, and then also doing the peel over, you know, there was a workaround to save it.
Yeah.
But what I'd be so curious to know, when they were inside of Amazon, when this was an internal project, did they say, well, it kind of looks like Hitler, but nobody will notice? Like, were they just blindsided when this went out into the general public?
I think they were blindsided. And I think, again, which is, we talk about this weekly, is that these internal design jobs aren't thorough enough. I think when you have an internal agency within your company that's already steeped in your company's culture, you know, they all just saw this as an Amazon box because that's, you know, they're the Amazon box people. But if you and I were designing, if I hung this on the wall and you and I ran a company, you'd be like, you'd tease me for a week. Oh, I remember that time you made the Hitler box. You know, you would not let this slide.
You're right.
And that's, you know, an agency would have the people in place. And even if it was a good idea, they'd be like, all right, Bob over there, see if you can fix it. Stan over there, come up with another one, because this may just be going down the tubes.
You're absolutely right, because I interviewed a guy a couple of weeks ago who does, like, you know, large scale consulting for, you know, the BMWs of the world. And I said to him, I'm like, is it that your all's ideas are so much better than everybody else's? Or is it that because you don't work for the company and consultants next to your name, they're actually willing to listen to advice from you that has probably been given to them from people down the corporate ladder that just people don't want to listen to because, like, that's just our fucking designer. He's difficult. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost, I know you've probably seen this. I've seen this before. There are people that are amazing clients, but you see how they treat their employees and you go, I'm so glad I'm collaborating with this guy. I would never, ever want to work for this guy. Big difference in collaboration and working for.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think quality design wise is the same way. I think stuff coming from inside the company is just going to get beat, you know, to death.
Right.
Every C-level guy is going to have to piss on it because that's their job.
Right.
And, you know, everybody's going to have to weigh in, and they're going to, you know, it's going to get designed by committee. Whereas, you know, if somebody goes out and says, we paid these guys $50,000 to do this, they're the experts. You know, your job is now to give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. You don't get to consult.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think you're probably going to, this came up a lot when we used to talk about the rebrands of like Facebook and Google, where they just went over to like a straight typography.
Right.
And I was like, all right, that's fine. It's sort of boring, mm-hmm. You know, like it's a missed opportunity. And, you know, so I think that's what these internal things do, is they're always really safe.
Right. Because they don't have the respect or the freedom to really, you know, swing for the fences, right? They're just, what are they telling me they want? What do they want different? And I think that, unfortunately, the problem with some of these people, and we've all had a job that done this, eventually a job will just beat you down to where, like, you forget what it means to be a good worker or a good designer. You get retrained on what will get approved, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you get a whole new skill set of, like, well, for the five people that are above me, this is what they want. So you just start learning how to please, because that gets you home at 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you even have jobs that do this. You know, even if you work for yourself, you just get those clients that are a pain in the ass. And by the fourth or fifth round of revisions, you're like, you know what? I'm going to do what's on this list. Check, 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 check. You just ruined it here. You know, give me my check. Get the fuck out.
Last thing. Go ahead.
Oh, and that's just what happens sometimes. You know, not every client is going to be a dream client. You're going to wind up spending 2 or 3 months on a project. You're going to beat yourself up trying to make it really good. They're going to beat you up trying to make it really bad. And at some point, you're going to cave. You're going to make something that's just going to get them the hell out of your office. And you're never going to put it on your portfolio.
I think that what you bring up is a good point, that at some point, what we have to learn how to do, especially if you're a freelancer, I mean, this would work for people that have a job, but more of a freelancer thing. You have to learn to work really hard for the clients that matter, that work hard for you. And you have to learn the ones where you're never going to convince them, and you just got to be a soldier, get the work done, cross them off, and move on. Because sometimes when you realize that you're the only one that cares, why? Why do you care if nobody else does? If you want to work on something where you're the only one that cares, launch your own brand, make your own products. But if you're working for a client and you're fighting really, really hard for good design and they don't give a fuck, it's just not a place to use your energy, because what you're going to do is, like I said earlier, you're going to get beaten.